Welcome to Season 2 and another edition of The Informed Gardener with your host, Dr. Linda Chalker Scott, Associate Professor and Extension Urban Horticulturist at Washington State University. And now, the science behind gardening with Dr. Linda.
Hi, I'm Linda Chalker Scott, and welcome back to Season 2 of The Informed Gardener. I'll help you become a more informed gardener in bringing you current and scientific information about all things botanical. And most importantly, I'll make this information not just interesting, but useful. Every week, we try to follow a theme throughout the podcast, and this week's theme is keeping cozy. We'll discuss the wisdom of using wound dressings and paints on damaged trees, and we'll also warm up indoors with tips from Dr. Rita Hummel on keeping your tropical plants cozy. But first, let's look at keeping cozy in the news. One of the things I really love about my wood chip mulch pile is that it's warm. So when I'm working outside in the wintertime, I sometimes bury my hands in it when they're cold. But this story in the news might make me rethink this wisdom. And this one is from sciencenews.com, entitled Gloves May Head Off Garden Variety Pneumonia. This story starts with a 67-year-old man who came to the hospital with complaints of feeling lethargic and confused and out of breath and just plain tired. It sounded like a case of pneumonia, so the doctors did a medical history on this man and found out he was a gardener. So they observed his hands closely and found out he had a cut on one of his fingers. And it turned out that 2 days before coming to the hospital, he had been gardening. He'd been working with compost and been working with a sharp tool like a trowel and had cut his finger and had gotten compost into it. So this immediately caused the doctors to do a urine test, which is a quick and easy way to find out if he'd contracted Legionnaire's disease, which is caused by a bacterium called Legionella. But the urine test came back clean, so he didn't have that particular disease. So they did a second test, and this time they tested his blood to find out if perhaps he had a different form of Legionella, a little rarer form that they weren't normally seeing in the United Kingdom. And it did turn out to be a different form of Legionella, and one that is resistant to antibiotics, at least the antibiotics that he was on right then. So they put him on another round of antibiotics. This time it worked fine. The guy is wonderful. He's out of the hospital. But the interesting thing is there's been more and more cases of this relatively rare form of Legionella popping up and popping up in people working with compost. So they found 9 instances in the last 26 years in the United Kingdom. But the odd thing is that 4 of those in the last 3 years. So it looks like the rate is picking up. And it's been such a cause of concern that even the Royal Horticultural Society has issued a list of recommendations relative to working with compost, wearing gloves, being safe when you're working around compost, because of this potentially deadly disease. Now, in Europe and North America, it's still pretty rare, but in Australasia, which is Australia, New Zealand, and the other islands that are associated in that area, it's very common. In fact, about half the cases of Legionnaire's disease is caused by this particular form of Legionella. So it's something that gardeners should be aware of. Even those of us in the United States that are working with compost, you may not have to worry about that particular form of Legionella, but it's probably a good idea to wear your gloves and make sure that you're not getting compost rubbed in any kind of open cuts on your hands. So think of this as just another way of keeping cozy. Keep your hands cozy with the gloves whenever you're working around compost. The second story is actually keeping cozy not for you, but keeping cozy for plants. And this is from Science Daily, and it's entitled Thermotherapy Rids Azaleas of Deadly Fungal Disease. So I have to say, when I hear thermotherapy, I think of an hour in the hot tub, but that isn't exactly what happens. Little background here. This disease is called azalea web blight, and it's caused by an organism called Rhizoctonia. And those of you that garden a lot outside with seedlings are probably familiar with Rhizoctonia because it causes things like damping off and root rot. So this particular Rhizoctonia affects azalea leaves, and you can't see it with the naked eye. You can only see the effects of it. So it's not something that's easily avoided. And the problem is that when people are cultivating azaleas, usually by taking cuttings and rooting them, that they can be transmitting this disease to all those new plants, and then you have to toss them all and you've lost a lot of money, or you have unhappy customers. So obviously it's a disease that should be avoided. Now you can use chemicals, but a lot of people are trying not to use chemicals for treating diseases anymore. And this particular group of researchers have found a non-chemical way of treating the disease. What they're doing is they're taking the cuttings and they're putting them in the hot water treatment for anywhere from 20 minutes to an hour. And when I say hot water, I mean 50 degrees Celsius, which translates to over 120 degrees Fahrenheit, a lot hotter than your hot tub. But they're finding that the plants actually can resist this temperature for a while, but it kills the disease. So the trick was to find out how long you can keep the cuttings submerged before it really damaged them, yet still wipe out the disease. In this research, they found if they left the cuttings in the water too long, that they would lose most of their leaves. And obviously, if you have a plant without very many leaves, it has a hard time surviving. So they were able to get it down to about 20 minutes at 50 degrees, and that was enough time to both kill the disease and not kill too many leaves, so that when the poor little cutting was planted out, it could develop new roots and eventually got some new leaves. And so this is a really remarkable and low-tech way of treating a potentially deadly disease on plants just by keeping them cozy. And so I suppose this is one of those times when getting into hot water seems to solve problems rather than to cause them. I really enjoy winter. I know it's probably not something many of you might say, but I really do enjoy being outside in the winter. But sometimes I like coming back indoors too. And many gardeners also enjoy gardening indoors, especially in the winter. So I thought we should visit with Dr. Rita Hummel, WSU's expert on interior plantscaping. This is the science, obviously, of keeping care of houseplants. Winter can be really tough on tropical houseplants especially, even when they're indoors. And Dr. Hummel is going to tell us why. I'm here in my office with Dr. Rita Hummel, who teaches interior plantscaping at Washington State University. And she's brought a very colorful looking houseplant into my office, and it's not necessarily a color I particularly like. Can you tell us a little bit about it, Rita?
Thanks, Linda. Yes, I brought in my chilling injured Silver Queen aglaonema. Silver Queen is the interior plant that is most susceptible to chilling injury. Chilling injury is injury that happens or occurs to interior plants. Plants of tropical and subtropical origin are the most susceptible, and of course that's where our interior plants come from, is the tropical, subtropical regions. Chilling injury is low temperature damage in the absence of freezing. So it typically occurs from, say, 55 degrees Fahrenheit, 50 to 55 degrees Fahrenheit on down to zero. There's been no freezing, but the plant is suffering from cold damage. It's actually a membrane phenomenon. Damage occurs to the plant cell membranes that creates a cascade of injury throughout the cell, and we end up with a colorful plant here that Linda doesn't like. This poor Silver Queen aglaonema typically has a green leaf with gray banding and bright green speckles on the leaf. It's one of the older varieties of aglaonema, and this one has been exposed to 45 degrees Fahrenheit when the boiler went out one night here just recently in our greenhouse. And what has happened is symptoms of chilling injury include leaf discoloration, maybe bending or curling of the leaves down. The leaf can have water-soaked, discolored necrotic. Necrotic means dead spots. Wilt is one thing that can occur as a result of chilling. Leaves drop. Plant doesn't grow. Ultimately, the plant can die. And the symptoms usually appear on the oldest leaves. And in the case of the plant I brought in, the Silver Queen, the oldest leaves are a canary yellow on this particular plant. And the youngest leaves are not showing any symptoms of chilling injury. They're still nice, brightly colored. And the intermediate age leaves show symptoms, basically some kind of greasy brownish spots on the leaves. And this is pretty typical of chilling injury in aglaonemas, Dieffenbachias, philodendrons. Pretty common in winter. We get our houseplants up too close to the window. We've got single-pane windows. Temperature drops down. They can be subject to chill damage. Chilling injury is both a temperature and time-related problem. So the lower the temperature, obviously, the greater the damage will be. But duration, the amount of time that the plant stays at that temperature, makes a huge difference.
So the first thing that you'll want to do, obviously, is stop the damage. So move the plant away from...
Stop the exposure to the low temperature. Get it away from the glass, if it's single pane glass. Or pull the curtains, maybe. Pull the drapes, something like that, to stop the exposure to the injury. Then what you would want to think about doing as far as, well, what can I do with my plant? Well, if we just look at this particular plant, we've got a tremendous gradation in damage from leaves that have no damage to leaves that are canary yellow to, if we get right down here, we actually have some that have turned crispy. They've been damaged long enough now that they've dried out. So what we would do is let's look at the really totally yellow ones. Those can go. They are distracting. They have no chlorophyll left. The chlorophyll's dead. The leaf is destroyed. Get rid of them. Then let's look at the rest of the plant, and we see some kind of brown, greasy spots, but maybe half the leaf or more is still green. Well, that leaf can still photosynthesize. It can contribute to basically restoring growth to the rest of the plant. So that's where you have to ask yourself, what's my tolerance for some kind of funky-looking colors on my plant? Can I tolerate a few brown spots and leave that leaf on the plant knowing that it's actually making photosynthate to help restore the growth to the rest of the plant, or aesthetically, I just can't tolerate that. I've got to cut that off as well, remove that leaf as well. But absolutely, you want to stop the exposure to the damage, to the temperature that's causing the damage. That's your first step. And then the other thing that you want to remember now is if you've cut these leaves off that are damaged, that are yellowed, you've just reduced the leaf surface, and maybe doing a quick estimation on this plant, we'd certainly pull maybe 20% of the leaves off if we cut off the really badly damaged leaves. So that plant's not going to require as much water. So be careful that you don't overwater the plant. Anytime you've had an episode where a bunch of leaves have been damaged and you've lost a bunch of leaves, keep in mind that now the plant needs a little bit less water. Cut back on the water. I've unfortunately seen plants that have been severely drought stressed, maybe lost 75% of their leaves, and the person that's taking care of them forgets that now we don't need as much water because we've got 75% less surface to transpire and lose water. So we're going to still keep watering them like we were. And now the plant dies because it's being overwatered. So don't get into that situation. Be very careful. You want to keep them watered. You don't want to water stress them, but you do not want to overwater the plant once it's come through a chill episode. As far as fertilizer is concerned, if you do fertilize, I use a very dilute, complete fertilizer. But I don't really think, as long as you've been taking care of the plant all along, that it's necessary right now. The days are really short, when we're coming into up on the 21st of December. So we're coming up to the shortest day of the year here. Short days, our house plants, our interior plants really aren't making that much growth. Maybe wait until early March to really start fertilizer, because it's really during that growing season for outdoor plants that our indoor plants, use the most or need the most fertilization.
So what plants would you recommend? Let's say that somebody likes living cool, or they're trying to save electricity, but they want to have some houseplants and they're worried about chilling injury. Are there some that you could recommend that aren't necessarily sensitive?
Well, I would stay away from the aglaonemas, the snake plants, and there are all different kinds of snake plants. You have the long, snaky-looking one, but you also have the bird nest one. So you can get some different forms, you can get different banding, coloration, so there are some variegated ones as well. So snake plant is a good one. Snake plant's a pretty tough plant anyway. Jade plant, these plants, if temperature goes low enough, they will suffer chilling injury too, but these are ones that, you could probably grow at a 55 to 65 degree day and a 45 degree night. I have a ZZ plant that I keep very cool. But one of the things to remember is that if you're going to cool these plants down, do it gradually. So let's not take a plant that's been growing at 70 to 75 degrees and pop it into 50 to 55, even if it is one of the plants that will tolerate this. Let's kind of take the temperature down gradually. Let's acclimatize it or acclimate it to those little bit lower temperature conditions if we're doing that. The most cold-tolerant interior plant is Swedish ivy, Plectranthus australis. And it's a very, very old one that has been grown for many, many, 100 years or more inside, and one of the reasons it did so well is because it is very cold tolerant. The fact is that, and we can call it the cultural history, if you will, of the plant, is important in whether or not it's going to be able to tolerate some chilling injury. For instance, pothos, which is a very common viney interior plant, was killed after 4 days at 40 degrees Fahrenheit, but if they brought it in from, say, 75 degrees, so 75 to 40, 4 days later, it's dead. But if it had been gradually exposed to 60 degrees Fahrenheit, then, so maybe 3 weeks at 60 degrees Fahrenheit, then it resisted chilling injury to 40 degrees Fahrenheit. So there is some ability of some of these plants to acclimatize, to tolerate a little bit lower chilling type temperatures. You really have to consider the cultural history. Things like a lot of water or a lot of fertilizer can actually create a situation where the plant is more sensitive to chilling injury. But I think the big thing for those of us that want to grow our plants in our homes, in our buildings, is to watch the situations where chilling damage would occur. And if you do have chilling injury, unfortunately, yellowed leaves, necrotic leaves, leaf wilt are symptoms of a lot of different interior plant problems, things like overwatering, things like underwatering, nematodes or something on the roots, root problems. These can all exhibit or present as yellow leaves, leaf wilt, leaf drop, things like that. So make sure that it isn't overwatering. Stick your finger in the media. Is it soggy, soaky, wet? Maybe pop the plant out of the container. Do the roots smell awful? Oh my goodness, you got a problem. And it's not chilling. But consider the potential for chilling when you see older leaves, especially yellowed, and then maybe some strange-looking browning or oily discoloration on the plant. Consider that it might have been chilled.
Every week on this podcast, I look forward to answering some of your gardening questions based on the theme of the show. This winter in particular, I've gotten several questions about treating tree wounds. Well, understandably, people want to clean the wound off and treat it with a wound dressing and get it all cleaned up and cozy and tidy so that it can heal itself, just because that's exactly what we would do when we cut ourselves. But this is actually one of the worst things you can do for your trees and shrubs. Interestingly enough, if you go onto websites, you're going to find all kinds of advice that tells you that you should buy product X because it is a clean, easy, simple way to aid in healing cuts and protecting tree wounds, pruned edges, and graft unions of roses, trees, and shrubs. That's a direct quote from one of these websites. So there's many of these, but my absolute favorite has to be this particular product. Listen to what it does. It seals electrical boxes and fittings. It's a gutting and flashing sealer. It will seal cracks in concrete and asphalt driveway. And, oh yes, it will also work as a tree wound dressing. Doesn't that sound great? Something that you seal cracks with in your driveway you would also paint on a tree. Well, if that one sounds a little tough, you'd probably like these other ones like aloe vera and some of these green products that are also marketed to treat tree wounds, which sounds, again, great because a lot of us use aloe vera to treat burns on our own skin. But trees and shrubs are not like people. They have woody tissues and they don't actually heal. What they do is they seal. And I'll explain that in just a minute, but I want to tell you what happens when you put wound dressings on plants. What happens is you will seal in moisture and decay. It also, depending on what it's made out of, can serve as a food source for microbes, which can be pathogenic and cause disease. It prevents wound wood from forming, and I'll tell you about wound wood in just a second. It inhibits compartmentalization, and it eventually will crack, and that will open the tree up once again to new sources of infection. So wound dressings don't prevent entrance of decay organisms, and they don't stop rot. And those are the two things people worry about when they get broken branches on trees or bigger shrubs. So what you have to do is remember that trees and shrubs have been around for millions and millions of years, and they have actually adapted their own ways of dealing with the various breaks and problems that they have. So again, what they do is they actually seal. They don't heal. And what that means is that when they make new tissues, they're not the same as the old tissues. So think about your own skin. You get a cut, it heals up, you get a little scab there, and you might have a scar, but the tissues that form are pretty much the same skin tissues that you lost in the first place. Well, in trees, it's not the same. So when you lose tissues on trees, they form something called wound wood or callus, and it looks quite a bit different than the original tissue. So this is just the way that the tree isolates off that wound, covers it up, and keeps any infection from spreading to other parts of the tree. And that's the way they deal with their various breaks and problems. So whenever you put any of these other substances on those tissues, what happens is you actually stop that sealing process. All these chemicals that the tree makes to seal itself off, which are very antibiotic in terms of keeping the microbes at bay, are inhibited when you cover them up because they need oxygen actually to work. So by covering up these cut surfaces, they can't make their own wound wood. They're sitting there bare and open to elements, and they just might get rot and disease faster because you've treated them with this stuff. Now, there are some exceptions to this. If you're pruning something where you're worried about particular diseases like oak wilt disease, or perhaps you're pruning when there's been some insects around that are carrying disease that you're worried about getting onto those cut surfaces, there are some products that are not paints or sealers. They're just a treatment, a very thin treatment that you put on those cut surfaces. And the other thing you want to be sure to do is to clean off your pruners before you make any cuts. It's pretty easy to do this, either with some kind of household cleaner or alcohol. Don't use bleach because it's really actually very bad for your pruners to do that. And that's a way of avoiding transmitting those diseases while you're pruning. So just remember that you don't want to be covering up and keeping cozy those wounded areas of your trees and shrubs. They're able to do it for themselves. This podcast is only one of the ways I provide science-based information for use in your own garden. For more, be sure to visit my webpage, theinformedgardener.com. It's my official Washington State University webpage, and it's full of great and free information. You'll also find archived podcasts from our first season there. Second, please join me and three of my colleagues at the Garden Professor's blog. It's at gardenprofessors.com. And the four of us take turns posting on just about any gardening topic you can imagine. You can even add comments if you feel so inclined. And finally, for those of you who will never give up books until they're pried from your cold, dead hands, I've written three books that might be of interest: The Informed Gardener, The Informed Gardener Blooms Again, and Sustainable Landscapes and Gardens. You can find out more information on all three of these books at sustainablelandscapesandgardens.com. In any case, I hope you found this podcast entertaining and useful. I welcome listener comments and questions, and please email me at lindacs@wsu.edu. Be sure to listen next time when our theme of our last podcast of the year will be resolutions.